Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Thanks for starting your week with us. We begin in El Salvador.
The fight against corruption, I think, is one of the pillars that made us won the election.
This is President Nayib Bukele speaking with Vice News back in 2019. He'd just won the presidency by a landslide at only 37 years old. And the people of El Salvador hoped that this new, young leader would bring about meaningful change.
The previous president, he's accused of stealing $300 million.
So you have faith that if you sort of change the image of what the government of El Salvador can do, how it operates, that people will start...
Not only the image, it's called momentum.
A small Central American nation of just over 6.5 million people, El Salvador suffers from one of the highest murder rates in the world, primarily because of unchecked brutality of gang violence. During the past 3 years, President Bukele has grown increasingly repressive as he's battled the gangs. And his approach has drawn both praise and criticism. In March of last year, The New Yorker reported that Bukele was enjoying 80% approval ratings and had earned the position of the most supported leader in Central America. And the support seems to be a mix of genuine appreciation for his policies and the result of a massive public relations campaign. It's support that persists despite global concerns about increasingly authoritarian and repressive tactics of governing. To help us understand the current situation in El Salvador, we talked with Jorge Cuellar, Assistant Professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth University. Can you give us a brief history of the origins of gangs in El Salvador?
Yeah, that is a really deep question. But I mean, the brief greatest hits of it is that the gangs actually begin among migrant Salvadoran people in Southern California, places like Los Angeles, and they kind of emerge in the middle of already a kind of gang-ridden city, right, with Black gangs and Mexican gangs. And so Salvadoran gangs emerge as a kind of survival strategy in the city. Soon after, they grow quite rapidly. This is late 1980s, early 1990s, when a lot of Salvadorans are coming to the United States, fleeing the Salvadoran Civil War that racked the country throughout the 1980s. And so at this point, you have tough on crime laws in the United States, especially in California.
Throughout the 1970s, Salvadoran people resisted repressive government regimes. These regimes were funded, supported, and weaponized by the U.S., which was typically more interested in halting the spread of socialism in Central America than in holding these leaders accountable for their human rights violations. Then, in 1980, social justice advocate and Catholic priest Archbishop Oscar Romero was assassinated while celebrating Mass.
After the shooting of Bishop Romero, for me was terrible, for so many persons was terrible, and The poor people said, who is going to defend us now? The situation was getting worse and worse until the civil war started 1 year later.
A video made by the UK-based charity organization, the Catholic Association of Overseas Development, tells the story.
He feared for his life, his own life.
On the evening of Monday, the 24th of March in 1980, Archbishop Romero was celebrating Mass in the chapel of the Hospital of Divine Providence, where he lived. He must have noticed a car drawing up at the door of the church. A marksman came out of the car and took aim and fired directly at the Archbishop.
After decades of unrest and repression, this was the final brutal act of indignity that the people of El Salvador refused to accept. The The Salvadoran Civil War began shortly after Romero's assassination and persisted for 12 years. The war took more than 75,000 lives and left economic devastation and political corruption in its wake. The length and brutality of the war was due in large part to the more than $1 billion in military backing from the U.S. to help El Salvador's government battle its own people. But many of those who fled to the U.S. seeking safety were instead deported.
And so many of these folks who are part of these organizations get deported back to Central America in the late 1990s, early 2000s, and they're forced to survive. And what they end up doing is finding one another, right? These deportees find one another. And that's how gangs get reproduced in Central America.
You know, as you talk about the origins, it's such an interesting reversal of kind of our typical public discourse, which is all about northward migration in order to escape gang violence. And then, you're giving us this counterflow that it is a deportation machine pushing folks south that is actually producing that very violence.
Yeah, I think that's precisely it. One thinks that migrants come here based on kind of Trumpian rhetoric. But in fact, what you have is that the problems of the United States in places like L.A., you know, produce gangs as a social form for survival. And then the very system of deportation and incarceration worsens that and sends these folks back to a Central America and reproduces that same cycle of the state doesn't know what to do with. And they try to confine them, they try to police them, they try to do all these things, but that creates an inhospitable climate for Central American people who then basically decide to leave, right? Based on that very reality that's produced by this kind of cyclical deporting of people into countries that don't have the institutions, that don't have the resources, are emerging out of these conflicts with all the trauma and fragmentation that entails. And that creates the conditions for gangs to multiply and also create a social environment that folks want to escape. And so it fuels that migration northward.
That vision you've just given us of trying to understand what to do in this case, and we can see the ways in which El Salvador is then responding in a kind of American-like confinement and incarceration response. So these data showing us that in April of 2021, El Salvador had about 36,000 people incarcerated, but there's been this dramatic increase over the past 2 years, so that now you have a much more almost American-level percentage of the adult population of El Salvador being incarcerated. Talk to me about mega prisons.
Yeah, so the mega prison is the result of a punitive, you know, and disciplinary policy against gangs and criminality that has been a long time coming. So just about every political administration since the early 2000s has often deployed this kind of tough on crime or iron fist approach to combating gang criminality, but it actually doesn't do what they purport that it should be doing, which is dissuading people and deterring folks from participating in gangs, right? And then you arrive at the last 2 years with the election of President Nayib Bukele, who presents himself as this kind of outsider, as somebody with new ideas. That's the name of his political party, Nuevas Ideas. But in fact, he's really just rehearsing and redeploying these similar policies of the last 30 years, but just in an intensified form. And that intensified form expresses itself as heightened militarization, equipping the police with new forms of surveillance. And all of this gets prototyped and pushed out there in El Salvador during the pandemic, where everybody's at home, where nobody should be outside, right? Where El Salvador was famous back then, too, 2 years ago, because of the military quarantine that Bukele implemented, where he was one of the first presidents in Latin America to shutter all borders. The phase one of this territorial control plan, as he would later call it, which is his tough on crime, iron fist approach, just under a different name. And alongside that, you have this approach of doing mega projects for the country.
One of those mega projects is a mega prison. In February, thousands of heavily tattooed Salvadoran men were herded into the new facility while cameras captured the images and beamed them across the world for international press. This is a report from NBC News.
The new complex, capable of holding 40,000 inmates, considered to be the largest of its kind in the Americas. The president touring the facility, fully equipped with armed guards and prison staff, workshops for inmates to manufacture goods, as well as dark isolation cells meant for solitary confinement and harsh punishment for, quote, anyone who tries to make any trouble.
The mega prison is supposed to house, you know, 40,000 people, the worst of the worst. And this is also a response to, you know, those images that you and I see all the time on the front page of the New York Times with these kind of dungeon-like conditions of overcrowded Salvadoran prisons with tattooed bodies, right? So it's a response to that. But it's actually an intensification where in that mega prison, he's trying to reproduce those conditions in a larger environment and creating these cells where gang members, supposed gang members, will not see a ray of sunshine for the rest of their lives. On March 27th will be a year since it was implemented. Over 65,000 people have been arrested and detained arbitrarily by this kind of emboldened police and security apparatus. And so they need a place to put these folks, basically, right? And so the mega prison also serves as a funnel to move some of these other prisoners into the mega prison. But this has also been this, the way that it's perceived in the media and the way we see it all the time is this tattooed gang member, a boogeyman, right? But that's really not real anymore. And what I mean by that is that the gang members don't tattoo themselves so visibly any longer. That's a practice that was done away with about 10 years ago. So the gang members that he's showcasing in the mega prison announcements and in the YouTube videos and things like this are older gang members. They're not the people that he's been picking up of these 65,000 that I just mentioned, which have been regular people who come from poor neighborhoods, from stigmatized communities. So it's been this kind of one-size-fits-all approach to capturing people and to detaining people in order to serve and populate these empty cells, basically, now. And so that's this model that Bukele has arrived at with the mega prison, which has been applauded the world over.
Presumably, to live in this state of exception, to give up some of these core rights, to have this mega prison that is subsuming and pulling in so many folks, presumably the trade-off is some notion of public safety. So let me simply ask you, is El Salvador becoming safer?
That's a really loaded question, as simple as it sounds. But I think from the point of view of regular people who live in some of these gang-ridden communities that have been under gang control for a very long time, from that point of view, yes, it seems very safe that things have changed, right? And that the country is going in a positive direction and Bukele is delivering on those kinds of security objectives that he ran on, right? And it's factually true. Gangs are in full retreat. I think this onslaught of the state of exception has been successful in having them step back and not collect on extortion payments, not intimidate people, right, not visit attack folks. But it remains to be seen if this semblance of temporary security is sustainable into the future because of what we already know. The state of exception cannot go on forever, right? Because it is supposed to be an exceptional moment of in order to address an emergency situation. So it's not sustainable politically and legally. The background of all of this is that this momentary security and safety was achieved through the curbing of constitutional rights, due process, human rights, right? All of these fundamental tenets and values that are at the core of democracy and democratic institutionality and good governance. And so that is the kind of other side of the coin. And right now, people are only, you know, reacting to that immediate feeling of feeling safe, of, you know, being able to walk the streets at night, of having kids play out in the field and things like this. But they're not seeing the kind of long-term effects that this will have in terms of the country institutionality and around constitutional rights and the ways that in the future, when for some reason they come knocking at their door, all these legal safeties and securities that a citizen would have been afforded in a previous moment are no longer around for them to utilize and to take advantage of and to seek redress and to seek justice and all these kinds of things, because the only arbiter of justice is the state, the police, and the military, right?
But is there actually a way to achieve like a type of level of safety and security in El Salvador that doesn't infringe on people's rights and autonomy?
What Bukele is showing is that democracy is an obstacle. And in fact, it gets in the way of doing things the way they need to be done in order to get the results that we want, which is why other leaders across the region and beyond want a kind of Bukele-like model in their country to address similar issues of criminality.
In certain ways, you've begun to respond to my next question, but I'm hoping you can tease this out for us. What do you see then as the future of El Salvador in this context?
Oh, that's the future, at least for the next 5 years. We already see that Bukele has made, you know, so many shifts and changes in the different institutions of government that he's basically going to run again in the next election, which is next year in 2024, even though that is not a constitutional right. So it's unconstitutional to run again. It's a single term. You get one shot. There cannot be consecutive terms. And so he's rewritten basically that part of electoral process and is going to run again. And he's incredibly popular, right? I think one of the Salvadoran newspapers, La Prensa Gráfica, just put out a result from a poll that he has a 91% approval rating, which is incredible. This is due largely to the fact that the security policy has been effective, but it shows that the security policy, the mega prison, you know, all the development projects, all of that is campaigning for 2024, which he's likely to win because there exists no real developed and coherent opposition to Bukele politically in the country. And so that's part of that future. And so what that means, right, if what Bukele has done has been to dismantle, you know, democratic process, to make the state of exception into a kind of permanent thing. It seems that this will continue on into the next, you know, administration, which is to be his. And at that point, you know, what will democratic institutions look like in El Salvador? What is governance going to look like? What does politics in general look like? Especially when he's centralizing every aspect of the state, and in many cases, disallowing for an opposition to exist, right? Many of the critics of the Bukele administration are now in exile in places like Mexico and the US and Spain, right? So people have been leaving because of this too, right? He's been going after, you know, NGOs and, you know, ridiculing human rights organizations and things like this. This is the kind of culture of hostility and inhospitability that this administration is cultivating, which makes it very difficult to do any kind of work to defend democracy, institutionality, or even serve as a watchdog of the country and of the country's politics and what he's doing. And so lastly, it's the human rights defenders who have been the most vocal, right? Cristo Sal is a really great organization, Human Rights Watch, of course, that have been, you know, a kind of counterbalance to some of the things that he's been doing with the terrorism containment center, the mega prison, and helping folks who have been unduly arrested and arbitrarily detained. So there's these kinds of small movements that are emerging, but they don't compare to the monopoly of the political environment that Bukele has achieved. And so I think that will continue into the future, and this will become an ordinary form of doing politics in the country, so that it makes other politicians that might emerge, right, almost inadequate to continue the kinds of successes with the popularity that Bukele has had. So in fact, it creates a very centralized political culture where Bukele is the only, you know, he's the messiah. He's the only one who can get us out of this. We have to continue to support him. We have to reelect him. We have to make sure that he gets what he needs because he's my lord and savior. You know, and this is the philosophy by many people who support Bukele, and likely that 91% that is enamored by what he's doing.
Stay with us. We're taking a break, and then we'll return to our conversation about modern El Salvador. It's The Takeaway.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back and talking about the new mega prison in El Salvador with Jorge Cuellar, Assistant Professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth University. Okay, Jorge, you've talked to us about the ways that U.S. policy has contributed to this problem. Are there policy initiatives right now that the U.S. could be engaged in that would help to alleviate it?
I think these have been happening for a long time, but the way that, for example, U.S. aid gets sent to Central America and to El Salvador specifically, sometimes that money and those resources don't get to where they need to go. They get siphoned off and into other places. And this is where security, as a kind of weird term, becomes a bit nebulous, where they send money for security to increase human security in El Salvador. Well, what does that mean, right? Does that mean investment in community development, in the creation of recreational, extracurricular kinds of activities for young folks? Or is it for more police and guns, right? And so it's very strange the way that gets played out after those resources are sent to Central America and to El Salvador. And so there needs to be more attention to the direction of where these funds end up and what they're doing. But we don't hear about that anymore, right? Because the mega prison is so spectacular and takes all of our attention. But there's already documented evidence that many of the folks who are part of the governing structure of El Salvador are corrupt actors. And so I think using that as the starting point for policymaking is important for the United States to really deliver on some of the documentation and evidence of corruption that they already have. That's one of them. And then the other thing being that the question that the United States cares about the most is migration. They want people to stop coming to the United States. That's fundamentally all they care about. They could really care very little about what's happening in El Salvador fundamentally if migration stops. At the end of the day, that's the thing that gives the United States anxiety. And during Bukele's administration, migration hasn't stopped. So then what is happening? In fact, it's gone up. Clearly, the security approach by Bukele has had some successes, but it hasn't curbed migration, which fundamentally is what the United States cares about in the end. And so from that point of view, if that's what they care about, they should look more closely as to why migration has not ceased. Is the fact that Bukele is creating a police state actually encouraging people to migrate, right? So what is happening? Is this attack that Bukele is leading to NGOs and to groups that support communities also part of creating a hostile environment that people are fleeing from? Is the focus of Bukele on, you know, foreign investment actually like displacing people from, you know, the communities that they live in, that they've lived for a long time, right? In order to make room for all these new projects. Is that leading to migration? So I think that the United States, as a matter of foreign policy towards Central America, should be looking more closely at some of those statistics and not just the very popularized and sensationalized successes around the mega prison.
Jorge Cuellar is Assistant Professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth College. Jorge, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Thank you so much, Melissa. This was wonderful.